Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Mazmi from Princeton University.
And I'm your co-host, Jenny Peruski from Harvard University.
Today, I'm here to talk to Professor Preeta Mayer, the author of Swahili Port Cities, The Architecture of Elsewhere, published by Indiana University Press in 2016. Preeta Mayer is Associate Professor of Art History at New York University. By discussing this book, we will explore the contested meanings of the built landscapes of still thriving East African ports, including Mombasa, Lamu, and Zanzibar. The book frames these places as porous sites whose architectures are constituted by itinerant practices of belonging that fundamentally challenge the racialized logic of colonialism and the nation state. Welcome, Preeta, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about your book today.
Thank you so much to both of you for inviting me to speak about my book. I'm really excited to actually have this opportunity to share my book with a wider audience.
Thank you. We would like to start by learning about you. If you can start this off by saying a few words about yourself. Where did you grow up? Where you went to school? How you became interested in art history and East Africa? And if you had any influential mentors along the way?
Sure, I'd love to start that. Telling you a little bit, I guess what many would have called or still would call and a little bit of an unconventional childhood. I spent most of my childhood in various communes, including in rural Germany, but also in India and other parts of South Asia, and also in Amsterdam. So my childhood was really extremely itinerant. Since my parents were really, quite frankly, just hippies, countercultural hippies, we spent a lot of our childhood, even when we were, or a lot of my time when we were even living in India, traveling across the Middle East and South Asia and Southeast Asia. And that really had a major impact in what I was interested in as I became older and when I became an art historian. Now, it just happened to that by accident, my parents immigrated to Florida when I was in high school. And that was in some ways, you know, sort of supposed to be a temporary space that we would land, but we ended up living there actually until I lived in Florida until I went to college and also went to the University of Florida for my undergraduate degree, where just by dumb luck, I happened to major in art history, and the art history department had a really well-known Africanist art historian. And I did my undergraduate degree with him. And in some ways, from then onward, there was really no looking back. I did my master's at the University of Iowa, which in the 1990s was an amazing concentration of Africanists who worked on the visual cultures and arts of Africa. So I had a whole coterie of mentors there, including the now well-known Africanists like Bill Dewey, Al Roberts, Polly Nutter Roberts, Vicky Rowine, Chris Roy. So it's like it was a place in the 90s where you had, you know, a real deep concentration of people who worked on the arts and visual cultures of Africa. But in between, I took a year off between doing my master's and my PhD, and I started actually working as an intern at the Michigan State University Museum to redo their African art installation. And there I became friends with a professor of African art history, who is now a professor at the University of Michigan, Ray Silverman. And he's really, in some ways, the key mentor of mine that shifted my perspective of what kind of Africanist art historian I wanted to be. And he really pioneered the study of what now is often called the Islamic arts of Africa, so the Islamic arts of sub-Saharan Africa. He was one of the few people who focused on that. For various reasons, in Africanist art history, Islamic arts of Africa was looked at even with some suspicion. Certainly, it was the margins of the discipline. It didn't fit into what would be considered "quote unquote" canonical African art. It wasn't small. It wasn't based on small community practices, communal practices. It was part of the global ummah. It was seen as suspiciously foreign. But Ray had been doing incredibly pioneering work on the Islamic arts of Ghana, for example, long before anyone even thought that was a legitimate sort of topic of study. And he really, in some ways, cemented and gave me the courage to focus on the Swahili arts of East Africa, which again was always almost just a minor footnote mentioned in passing in courses or books and articles written by Africanist art historians. Then I had the good fortune to work with Professor Suzanne Blier at Harvard University. I did my PhD with her. And she was also, and still remains to be, a key mentor of mine, because she's one of those amazing mentors who demands of her students that they ask larger questions and that they really work hard at making sort of she really challenges all of her students to write dissertations that really challenge disciplinary norms and sort of push the study of, let's say, the arts of Africa into new directions. So that those are in some ways the people who formed in some my scholarship up to this day.
Thank you for that. So interesting to hear about your background and what brought you to this moment of writing Swahili Port Cities. And so maybe turning then more specifically towards your book, I understand that this research developed out of your PhD dissertation, Local Cityscapes and Transcultural Imaginaries, Competing Architectures of Mombasa. Is that correct? And if so, how did that initial dissertation idea develop? What was your research process like, and how did you develop it from a dissertation to a book?
It was a long and arduous transformation from dissertation to book, I have to tell you, but I'll get into the details of that. So by the time I was doing my master's at the University of Iowa, I had already committed to focusing on the arts and architectures of the port cities of the Swahili coast, because they are just, I even realized early on that they were incredibly productive to think with and to question sort of the received paradigms of what constitutes African art, African culture, right? Because they were, in some ways, port cities are oceanic, port cities are transitory spaces, they're spaces of transition, they, of course, are deeply connected to the African heartland, the mainland, but they're also always faced towards the ocean. And because Swahili port cities have been historically Muslim, cultural complexes. They, from the beginning, troubled Africanist art history, as I had been taught since undergraduate. So I was already focused on that from the beginning. And I was always, in some ways, I was lucky because once I ended the PhD program, I knew that this is what I wanted to focus on. And so when I started developing my dissertation, I was in some ways struggling how and where to anchor my research. Should I do multiple cities? Should I focus on one city? And for my dissertation, especially for the proposal, I focused on Mombasa, just because in some ways I needed a strong sort of physical anchor, because one striking feature about littoral societies and coastal societies is, of course, they take you, they're conduits, so they take you in many directions constantly. So in some ways it was particularly challenging to anchor myself, and I anchored myself in a single city, Mombasa, because in many ways I was very much still dedicated to the tradition of rigorous at least 1 year of field work for the dissertation. In some ways I'm trained as an Africanist, where you have to do at least one sustained continuous year of field work in one site. And so I received a Fulbright-Hayes dissertation research fellowship, which brought me to Mombasa to do my research. And once, of course, you land in Mombasa and you try to figure out what even the questions it is that you're trying to ask, you're, of course, faced with the intense reality of everyday lived experiences of people living in Mombasa. And I didn't even focus on all of Mombasa. I really just focused on Old Town Mombasa, that is the historical heart of the old harbor town. And in some ways, it was a tiny part of contemporary Mombasa, what it is actually today. And to tell you the truth, in some ways, what I did was completely contrarian of what a sort of good art historian should have done, because, I mean, I had been going to Zanzibar, Lamu, and Mombasa, for short summer research trips long before I started my year-long dissertation research. And I mean, as anybody will know, is that Lamu and Zanzibar, of course, are visually much more compelling, right? They have these picturesque heritage sites that have been renovated and in some ways reinvented also for the tourist industry. Lamu is celebrated as sort of the last bastion of a classic pure, in some people's worldview, Swahili heritage that hasn't been sort of mucked up or become too colonial or too post-colonial. For the fact that Mombasa was actually none of those things. Mombasa is very much, even Old Town, is not at all a pretty revitalized heritage site that's easily consumed by tourists. It doesn't even have a single tourist hotel within the boundaries of Old Town. And it doesn't have sort of this very beautiful classic Swahili style of architecture. Now, it's there if you look carefully. But in some ways, it's totally counterproductive for an architect, for an architectural and art historian to do their dissertation research on a city that is actually not at all at first glance aesthetically seductive and doesn't have major monuments to do research on, right? But in some ways I was in my early years doing my dissertation, really in some ways also trying to a little bit, I don't know, critique the discipline of Africanist art history, which of course focuses on beautiful monuments, well-known sculptures, sort of the canon of African art. And so I picked a city that almost doesn't make sense for that. Of course, it's made my life difficult later on, but that's another story. But so for me, Mombasa was this place that was so extremely alive from the perspective of lived experience. Now, that doesn't mean that Zanzibar and Mombasa are not equally alive from lived experience. But what fascinated me, that which is a little bit different from Zanzibar and Lamu, is that there is a group of ancient families that now claim the title of belonging to what's called the Tenashara Taifa, or the Federation of 12, which are 12 indigenous lineages. You know, they still have a very active, vibrant role in Old Town, and they have contested colonial, including Busaidi Omani claims, British claims, and also recent mainland claims to Mombasa. They're very much a vibrant, strong voice that still live in Old Town and that still have, you know, constantly push back against new claims or new communities living in the town. So I was really fascinated in the fact that this, the Tenashara Taifa, was so present in the town, and that, you know, for example, some of the most sort of vibrant public historians of old Mombasa, Old Town Mombasa, that I had met briefly on preliminary research trips, like Mzee Mohamed Motano, were members of the one of the lineages of the Tenashara Taifa, who really had these very strong views and claims to the city. So I really, in some ways, wanted to do, even though I am trained and I'm committed to be an architectural historian, I wanted to focus on these oral histories. I wanted to really do a rigorous history of the urban life and the material life of Old Town Mombasa. And in some ways, what happened then, I would say that in terms of mentors, the most important mentor after my academic mentors in universities in North America was Mzee Matano, who passed away in 2015 before my book was published. But he really took me under his wing. And I spent hours interviewing him, interviewing members of his community. That and of course, the longer I lived in Mombasa, I became aware that Mombasa, of course, is multiple cities, right? In some ways, without a doubt, my version of Mombasa, or the history of Mombasa that I told in the dissertation, and in some ways also tell in the book, in the subsequent book, really focuses on the perspective or the version of Mombasa of the Tenashara Taifa. But one of the, of course, complications of doing urban field work, although I'm sure this is not just a matter of urban field work, but nonetheless, Mombasa is a densely multiple city in some ways. There are many cities within Mombasa because there are multiple communities living just in this tiny space of Old Town Mombasa that includes mainland Africans, Badala, Isnasharis, Hindu communities, new Arabs, old Arabs. So what I also became aware of the longer I lived in Mombasa, that of course there were all of these communities who all had their own versions of Mombasa. So the dissertation really focused on the multiplicity of those stories, although always emphasizing the Tenashara, the Federation of 12, perspective. And I also did an intense amount of archival research for the dissertation on urban planning politics, on the making of the colonial state. I went to the Kenya National Archives. And I also did take also short research trips to Zanzibar and Lamu, because of course, when you start doing sort of deep research of any Swahili port city, you realize that they're in some ways neighborhoods or fragments of other port cities. So you can't really do Mombasa without understanding Lamu or Zanzibar. Of course, you also then realize you can't do Mombasa without understanding heartland caravan towns like Ujiji or Tabora or Muscat in Oman. But nonetheless, I became more and more aware that actually port city research always takes you to other places. And then I came back from fieldwork and had to write up my dissertation that had all of these endless, you know, in some ways I didn't really know where I was going to take the dissertation. Was it going to be Zanzibar and Lamu and Zanzibar and Mombasa? Should I include Ujiji, Tabora, Muscat? Of course, I would have never finished my dissertation. So quite frankly, with the advice of my dissertation advisor, Suzanne Preston-Billier, I decided to focus really into a case study for the dissertation on Mombasa. But really, it never stayed there. I mean, if you read the dissertation, it's full of anecdotes or links or connections to all the other port cities that are key to Mombasa as well. And then for the dissertation, I realized that the dissertation, in some ways, the title that it was about Mombasa was not, in fact, really accurate. And I understood that for the book, I had to really anchor my multi-layered narrative. I really always struggled in the dissertation to make sense of all of these multiple voices, multiple stories I wanted to tell. And the story I really wanted to tell is, you know, how the colonial moment, this watershed moment, really radically reconfigured how people interpreted the material remains, the physical built environment, right? That all of a sudden new categories of signification like race, ethnicity started being projected onto the built landscape, including the built landscape of Mombasa, Lamu, and Zanzibar. At the same time, I was deeply committed to historical ethnography that is focusing really on how really the many post histories of the built landscape, how people's memories, practices, engagements with the built landscape changes over time. And by built landscape, I don't just mean sort of the large monuments, although I do focus on those as well. But the large man, of course, I focus on large monuments in the book, like merchant mansions, mosques, palatial structures like the House of Wonders, but also the interior of the built landscape, like the living spaces in these merchant mansions. So, I mean, I have a very sort of like larger definition of built landscape, basically the entire urban scape and how people make a living in the urban scape. But again, I was struggling how to anchor it. So from the dissertation to the book, I made the choice to write four chapters that were really in some ways distinct case studies of very concrete things. That is to anchor my multiple strands analysis of the urban scape of Swahili port cities in concrete case studies, right? So I did the urban fabric, the urban layout of Mombasa, and then specific mosques, a single palace for one chapter, and then the microcosm of interiors of people's houses. So that allowed me then to anchor what really is in some ways this constant moving back and forth between the past and present. How people like Mzee Matano and other key people in Old Town, but also people living in Lamu in Zanzibar, narrate their understanding of the built heritage, how they understand how the built heritage sort of changed how they relate to their past. And one thing that Mzee Matano really helped me see is that while without a doubt colonialism was exploitative and unjust, and it radically reconfigured how people relate to their past, to their built heritage, local people, right? There's this contestation to this day, very much alive in all Swahili port cities, where people are asking themselves, whose heritage is this? How do we define the built heritage, especially the stone coral buildings that are recognized for their grandeur and beauty? How do we categorize it? Who does this belong to, right? If you ask people in Kenya today, if you ask people in Zanzibar today, there's a contestation. Is this architecture, how should we label it? Whose culture is it? Is this the architecture of quote unquote the Swahili people, which of course raises the question, who are the Swahili people? Is this an Arab architectural form? Is this a mainland architectural form? Who does it belong to, right? And Mzee Mantano really showed me that that I have to foreground individual interpretations of these larger questions. The other thing that Mzee Mantano really showed me is that, yes, colonialism was a watershed moment that radically reconfigured and radically, changed the politics of interpretation of these forms. In some ways, Swahili built history, Swahili built form, Swahili ways of living in port cities and making port cities was not interrupted by colonialism, that Swahili ways of building port cities, of making port cities, of living in port cities is an ancient practice, and that colonialism was just a layer of many ancient practices. And one of those ancient practices is that Swahili port cities have always been places that are connected and constituted by networks and building community across the Indian Ocean. Now, they're also about networks and building community across the mainland into the heartland of Africa. But because of the symbolic significance of claiming Swahili port cities to be Muslim port cities, this emphasis on connecting Africa and connecting Swahili cities to the oceanic, to the larger world across the Indian Ocean, that is the larger world of global Islam. And this narrative of this of port cities being about a global community of Muslims becomes incredibly important and is incredibly important to how people, no matter what ethnicity or lineage they claim, is incredibly important to people in Mombasa, Lamu, and Zanzibar today.
Wonderful. Thank you for that super fascinating look at kind of the interconnections between the cities in Lamu, Mombasa, Zanzibar, and even beyond there to elsewhere across the Indian Ocean. And maybe now is a good point to jump into the chapters to take a little closer look at your book.
Sure.
The book consists of four chapters, each focusing on a small number of buildings or a series of interconnected spaces, as you've alluded to, within a specific city. In the introduction entitled The Place in Between, you raise a lot of big questions relating to the historiography of the Swahili coast, namely, where do Africa, Asia, and Europe begin and end, as you said? How is quote-unquote international and or quote-unquote foreign defined by a residence of the Swahili coast, as you've discussed? And what is the relationship between past and present? And you've expanded on these points by unpacking the notion of the place in between, right? Mm-hmm. And in relation to that, on page 13, you say, quote, "While in reality, stone and earthen structures intermingle and are part of the same spectrum of building technology, conceptually, stone is linked to the sea and earthen houses to mainland Africa." If you can elaborate a little bit on this sentence by thinking about the relationship between building materials and coastal identities, how do you see these two enmeshed together?
Oh, yeah, that's an important question. So, to first go back to your point about, you know, it is true that in my introduction and then certainly even throughout the book, I very much constantly raise questions of methodology and historiography. And, you know, there's, of course, many ways of doing scholarship, but it's always been my practice to really foreground, you know, the politics of interpretation, even of my own scholarship or my introduction. I very clearly signpost all the different sort of disciplinary discussions that I seek to intervene in, or what specific sort of adjacent disciplines That I'm sort of engaging like archaeology, anthropology, and history, which are, of course, not my own disciplines. Because what really fascinated me and always to this day fascinates me is how different disciplinary training will cause you to ask different questions of the subject matter that you're interested in. So I was already, when I was doing my MA and certainly when I was doing my PhD, fascinated that sort of the questions that people were asking about Swahili port cities depended very much on what discipline that the scholar was from. And what I was really aware is that the fact that the Swahili coast sort of exists at the margins of African cultural studies had to do with the fact that Africanists just were not trained to ask questions about places that were transcultural, that were transnational, that were oceanic. And of course, that made me realize that the sort of old area studies paradigm, and of course, I was part of a wave in the 1990s in the humanities and the social sciences, where people were starting to question, you know, what are the advantages and disadvantages of the area studies paradigms that we did research in, right? That is, Asian studies or South Asian studies, African studies, Middle East studies, right? And when I asked this question in the beginning of my book, where does Africa, Asia, and Europe begin and end? The Swahili coast, of course, although all places, I think, will allow one to question those continental categories to make sense of history and lived experience. But the Swahili coast really sort of throws the simplistic nature of using continental categories to make sense of history and people. The simplistic nature of those categories throws that really into sharp relief. And so, you know, you realize that from the perspective of an Africanist who's trained to focus, let's say, on mainland Africa, Swahili coast culture and the cities itself are very African. If you're trained like a South Asianist, you see many South Asian cultural histories alive and well in Zanzibar, Mombasa, and Lamu. And certainly if you're a scholar of Europe, because of the, you know, of course, impact of colonialism, you could also see many aspects of Zanzibar, Lamu, and Mombasa that are very European, right? So really if you shift your focus from different disciplinary lenses onto Swahili port cities, they are really these prisms of multiplicity, right? So again, how do you try to then anchor your analysis of prisms of multiplicity? I realized that the best way to do that was to focus on built form. That is something as seemingly sort of timelessly permanent and dense as stone architecture, right? Stone worked architecture, because it's seen as this ancient, unchanging heritage, right? But then when you look at the building tradition of a stone or the way that stone architecture is narrated from the local perspective, it's always narrated as you pointed out in what you had just quoted from my book, as somehow being more about somehow being oriented towards the sea, right? That makes it the stone architecture, the building of cities using coral stone masonry architectural technologies makes Zanzibar, Lamu, and Mombasa distinct from the African mainland. Now, that is really a symbolic strategy, because as archaeologists have a symbolic claim, right? Because in reality, you know, building technologies don't rupture radically once they get to the Swahili coast. Built stone is, of course, also used in mainland architectural forms. And if you do a close analysis, there is no radical rupture. But for the making of a claim of significance of these, of singular importance of Zanzibar, Lamu, Mombasa as Muslim port cities, right, that belong to the sisterhood and brotherhood of global Islam, there begins, you know, in the oral histories, an emphasis on claiming that building in stone is a way to create Islamic space on the Swahili coast. Now, this is a distinctly Swahili interpretation of built architecture, because, of course, in other parts of the larger Muslim world, this sort of focus on this, like really honing in that architecture built in coral stone makes this city a Muslim city. This one we could even say an obsession is, of course, not in place in other parts of the Muslim world. For example, Tuaregs, you know, transhuman cultures of the Sahara, of course, build Muslim space with, you know, impermanent architecture. There's not this claiming of stone as being so exceptional. Is not there. But for the Swahili coast narration, especially, I want to emphasize the Swahili coast narration of the past, of this past in the 20th century, this becomes absolutely essential. And of course, what is also important to point out, and I get into this in other parts of the book, is that as a building technology that is turning coral stone into permanent stone monuments is a unique technology that artists, craftsmen, architects really master on the Swahili coast, because turning living coral or dry coral into monumental stone architecture is a unique way of turning the earth into a permanent architecture. But I wanted to also get back to your point about this, you know, my notion of the in-between. In some ways, of course, that's really the abiding conceptual framework for the entire book, that the Swahili coast, its architecture is a place of in-between. Now, I mean that on many levels, on also an intellectual or historiographic level. I mean that the Swahili coast is a place of in-between area studies, or between the accepted boundaries that we have drawn around cultures, right? The idea that there is such a distinct thing as Asian culture, African culture, European culture, Middle Eastern culture, right? To me, these are still very much alive truisms that certainly have their origins in nation building in the 19th century. But of course, these are conceptual leftovers from the age of empire, although, again, they are more with us than they ever have been today in this age, for sure. But the Swahili coast, the culture of the Swahili coast, the history of the arts of the Swahili coast, of course, trouble the truisms of that, right? They really explode the fabricated notion that we can create ethnic or continental boundaries around history and the making of culture, right? Because one thing that is absolutely without a doubt so incredibly wonderful to think with, and that is the history of Swahili art, is that it is not anchored in one nation state. It's not anchored in one continent. It's not anchored in one civilizational narrative, right? Because that's an art practice. It's a urban history that is about transnational connections. It's about a building cities that look like places far away. Now, of course, these cities are unquestionably African cities, if you want to focus on that aspect, because they're built on the African continent, for sure. But in some ways, they are about strategic ways of overcoming the limitations of being part of one locality. And port cities are merchant cities, and of course, sites of intense economic, cultural, and social competition, right? So everybody, of course, interesting throughout the history of Swahili port cities, tries to claim them for themselves, right? So there's today, to this day, this contestation: are these cities Arab? Are these cities African, right? And one thing that is absolutely fascinating to me, although I very much lay out in the introduction that without a doubt, the scholarship that came of age in the post-independence period on the material remains and built heritage of the Swahili coast proved that Africans built Swahili port cities. But of course, Africans are complex, multi-layered societies themselves, right? But it was very important during the to overcome colonial narratives and colonialist and racist colonialist interpretations of the built heritage of the Swahili coast in the 60s and 70s. So archaeologists really showed us that there is nothing simply foreign about the stone architecture of the Swahili coast, that it wasn't just brought, quote unquote, as colonial era. Archaeologists wanted to claim that as colonial era, British archaeologists wanted to claim that the ancient great remains of cities like Kilwa and Husuni Nkubwa were built by quote unquote Arab colonialists in the distant past, that is absolutely not true. That is a racist interpretation of architecture. There is, right, as you know. And so, you know, but it's interesting that, you know, even though I lay that out very clear in the introduction, I oftentimes get, you know, people saying, well, are you saying it's not African, right? There's, because there is still, especially in East Africa, you know, there is, but also among scholars of a certain generations, there is this, what I would call maybe unfairly, but that's how I see it, an obsession with origins. You know, can you get to the essential ethnic, racial origins of a built heritage? Which in some ways, of course, is a very strange project, right? We don't have this obsession with trying to get to the ethnic, racial heritage, for example, of Gothic architecture of, you know, 14th century Germany, right? I mean, but there's this strange disquiet that still shapes how Swahili coast cities are interpreted. And really in my introduction, I try to really clearly lay out how we have to move beyond that without, of course, forgetting that strategically there is a claim to the elsewhere through stone architecture, that Swahili merchants, and Swahili merchants have, of course, family connections to mainland Africa, to the Arabian Peninsula, to other port cities along the Swahili coast. But there's a strategic claim to say this stone architecture is like the stone architecture of, let's say, the Arabian Peninsula, or, for example, Shiraz or ancient Persia, because it's strategically smart for merchants to claim belonging to other important port cities across the ocean, important port cities that before the early modern, before the colonial and modern period, were of course part of a network of Muslim trading cultures, right? So this connection to other Muslim centers was absolutely essential. So there was a strategic claim. It's important to make that point that says these cities are oceanic cities. These are Muslim cities. And the stone architecture makes us oceanic Muslim cities.
Absolutely.
But from the form of technology and real history of material form, they are part of the earthen built structure of Africa as well.
Absolutely. And I think from your introduction, we get a real sense of the broader scope of these connections between the coastal East Africa and inland East Africa, but also these connections broader, and that these aren't simple binaries.
Yes.
And so then kind of going into your chapters, I think what's really interesting is that each of these chapters kind of breaks down different aspects of interconnectivity between space and kind of artistic expression and kind of broader historiographic issues of how we really come to see individuals' place in the world. And so I'm going to jump ahead a little bit towards chapter 4, okay, where you talk about the stone house. And as you have talked about in many places, but particularly in your book, the stone house on the Swahili coast is historiographically fraught. Can you discuss some of the issues in approaching the Swahili home and your intervention in this chapter on the nature of cultural consumption on the Swahili coast and the boundaries between local and foreign associations with objects.
Oh, yes. That's yes, there's nothing you really honed in on this. Yes, stone houses on the Swahili coast are very historically fraught. In some ways, I was already alluding to that in my what I was just saying a few moments ago. But there is nothing more overdetermined and sort of overladen with ideological contestations, at least from my perspective, than the stone house of the Swahili coast, right? In some ways, right, this sort of seemingly relatively humble, but also, of course, beautiful structure, like these, you know, merchant mansions, you know, oftentimes no higher than, you know, the most grandiose were maybe three, at the most four stories high, right? They, you know, symbolize the sort of permanence of elite families, right? I mean, in the until the 19th century, really only freeborn, wealthy merchant or plantation-owning families had the pedigree and the financial means to build stone merchant houses, because building in coral stone is actually an incredibly laborious, complex technology. You can't build a stone house even if you have 1,000 masons ready to build it in 1 month, because coral stone has to set. Coral rag, especially when it's still alive, when it's still coral, is a very malleable soft stone that, of course, allows you to manipulate it and carve it and turn it into load-bearing walls and intricate decorative ornamental programs, right? But you have to build it very slowly, right? And usually a stone house belonged to a family for generations, and it was slowly expanded on, you know, it turned into a multi sort of like and sort of multi had multiple roofs and sections and stages, and it took a long time to build, right? So it already has this sort of like this idea that it represents the permanence of really powerful pedigreed families, the Wangwana of the Swahili coast, as they're called in Swahili, right? And to be the rightful owner of a family of an ancient stone mansion means that your family has pedigree, right? Your family has always lived on the Swahili coast. I mean, of course, this can be a fiction. You can actually buy, of course, a house, but that's another story. But nonetheless, these are sort of these, once again, so wonderfully paradoxical. Stone houses have this sort of the sheen of eternal permanence, right, on them or in them. You can project this idea that your family have always lived on the Swahili coast. Your family has always been an important Muslim family that has been the gatekeeper and the keeper of classic Swahili Muslim culture, right? But of course, what happens in the 19th century, and perhaps it happened earlier, but we really can track it from the 19th century onward, is that the Swahili stone house, of course, becomes extremely contested, because it's seen as this ancient symbol of heritage and culture, that people who live in the stone houses of port cities, they are the gatekeepers, the fathers and mothers of the city. By claiming stone architecture and stone houses as your heritage, you also have claims to these cities themselves. You are the gatekeepers, the keepers of these cities. You are the owners of the cities, right? So claims to stone houses also then become claims to the rights of the city, the rights of the city, of course, also including the being the beneficiaries of its economies, right, of controlling the global economy in commodity trade, the global economy in the creation of plantation crops like cloves and grains, right, to feed the global capitalist economy, right, or you are, of course, the beneficiaries and the owners of enslaved Africans who are building, you know, and who are the workers and the laborers on these huge coastal plantations that start being established on the Swahili coast in the early 19th century by the Busaidi sultans and their intermediaries, including South Asian financiers, and of course the consumers of these commodities like spices and grains, which of course is Europe. So all of a sudden there's this question, who owns stone houses? Whose heritage is it, right? Because during the colonial period, you start having this disenfranchisement of ownership of stone houses, of Swahili coast old lineages like the Tenashara Taifa, right? They become marginalized in their own cities. They start losing control over the stone heritage of the Swahili coast. And more you see, of course, the rise of powerful Arab families, newcomers. I want to emphasize, there have always been old Swahili Arab families living on the Swahili coast. But with the colonization of the Swahili coast by the Busaidi dynasty, of course, Busaidi and other important Omani families become also start claiming the stone architecture and the stone houses of the Swahili coast, including in Mombasa. So more and more you have then stone houses being connected to Arabness and connected to that it is the heritage of Arabs. And you have this sort of disenfranchisement of what we would call now Swahili indigenous families. And of course, in the historiography, this becomes an issue, right? Who is this Swahili heritage? Is this African heritage? Is this Arab heritage? And then also the larger question is, why celebrate stone houses as the great heritage or the great cultural monuments of the Swahili coast when from the perspective of many mainland Africans who were enslaved, who came to the coast as unfree laborers to work on plantations, this heritage are, you know, remind these stone houses, these ostentatious merchant mansions are symbols of the violence and violation of their bodies, of their people, right? Because without a doubt, some of the grandest stone houses of the Swahili coast were built with the unprecedented massive wealth of slaving families, right? So one beautiful thing about stone houses is because they are permanent, they still stand, they act as scaffolding of unforgetting. That is, people refuse to forget these popular histories that are told, for example, that are still told today, that stone houses house the remains of the embodies of the enslaved, that people had sacrificed enslaved Africans to strengthen the walls of the most ostentatious and beautiful stone houses, right? So then the question is, well, why are we set from a perspective of a mainlander, why are we even celebrating this history or this heritage, right? And these are the things that, of course, I grapple with all the time in the book. And without a doubt, when you ask people on the Swahili coast what Swahili architecture is, it really depends who you ask. For many people, Swahili architecture is not stone houses, but the earthen architecture of Makuti houses, right, that are built with palm fronds historically.
Yes, and you unpack this beautifully and distangle these contestations throughout the book. In chapter one, difference sit in stone, place and race in Mombasa. In chapter two, a curious minaret, sacred place, and the politics of Islam. And chapter three, architecture out of place, the politics of style in Zanzibar. I'd like to ask you if you can bring these three chapters together to think about race, to think about Islam, and the politics of style between what you call the moment of rupture, right, and after. Mm-hmm. How do you see race, Islam, and style coming together and coming apart after colonialism into the 20th century?
Wow, that is a very, very large question, but a very important question. I'll try to do it justice. Whew. So, for me, the, in some ways, one of the, for me, the hardest chapter to tell you to write, and the one that I knew was the most controversial, but in some ways the most important, was chapter two. I mean, it starts with chapter one, the difference set in stone, right? But it really continues with chapter two about these two pre-colonial mosques, the Mandri Mosque and the Besheikh Mosque. And they are stone-built monuments that have an ancient history. One dates to the 16th century and one, I think, to the 14th century. And so these are these ancient buildings, stone buildings, right, perceived as permanent and unchanging, right? Like all stone architecture of the Swahili coast, it these monuments become incredibly contested, the same way the larger urban fabric of Mombasa becomes contested in terms of who has the right to these cities. And in these terms are played out in the context of Islam and race and built form, right? Style, right? And you perfectly honed in on these three things that interplay with each other in a very complicated way, right? So my point is that, of course, the perceived permanence of stone in some ways is really just a fiction, because the constant ways different plural and transitory associations are projected onto particular buildings, right? This, I mean, and without a doubt, I map out in the first chapter, Difference Set in Stone, how architecture and the built environment becomes racialized and becomes through really the colonial project that is the British colonial project. Although it's important to say, and scholars like Jonathan Glassman have also really powerfully argued, that to say that there were no issue, that the Busaidi colonizers had no notion of race and did not racialize, is also not true. And in fact, I found many archival sources that really also show this sort of the racialized hierarchies that Busaidi colonizers were projecting onto the architecture. Although one could also, of course, say that Busaidis were also appropriating British colonial categories as well. That's another very complicated and very contested sort of footnote, but it's important for me to signal that right now in this moment.
Yeah, but that nostalgia for
yeah.
Sort of perfect, almost timeless past in which everything was better in other yeah. terms. There was a lack yeah. of racialization and all of that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Point that out. You know, I mean, the writing of history of port cities in the Indian Ocean, not just Swahili port cities, of course, is really complicated, because they're always connected to, you know, they are in fact connected to ethnic histories and written in the modern period, right? So there's, you know, the question of, you know, what the Busaidi role was, and who, you know, what kind of, you know, sort of what kind of history the Omanis had, and what kind of, you know, how, what kind of colonizers the Busaidis were, is very contested. Many people have this romantic notion, as you know, and many people, of course, who return from Oman to the Swahili coast after the 1964 revolution of Zanzibar, of course, you know, have a very different sense of their heritage and their culture, or their impact on the Swahili coast, right? I mean, that whole side, and I'm grappling with more and more, but that's a very complicated story. But certainly this idea that, you know, plantation slavery or Omani Busaidi colonialism was benign, it was just some sort of like, you know, brotherhood among Africans and Arabs, is of course also not accurate. Nonetheless, I do want to emphasize right here in this moment that this, you know, this colonialist narrative of quote unquote evil Arab slavery is also a complete simplification and a racist colonialist narrative projected onto the Middle East, right? So there's this, that's also important to emphasize. But what I do in my chapter 1 and 2 is focus on how, in fact, built form is racialized, both the style and who has access to it. And let's focus on the particularities of these two masks as sort of case studies. The Mandri mask and the Bashaikh mask were, according to Talatha Taifa elders, right? And I want to emphasize, this is again what makes urban history so complicated. There are, of course, multiple communities living in Old Town Mombasa who all have, in many ways, their own claims and their own interpretation of the heritage of Old Town, right? In chapter 2, I definitely focus on the Talatha, which is a subset of the Tanashara Taifa, right? It's a the federation of three, right? I definitely focus on their narration of how they are, how their claims to Islam and built stone architecture gets delegitimized during the colonial period, and how they are racialized, and how this the Talatha Taifa and the Tanashara Taifa or the Swahili people are turned into quote unquote native Africans, while certain other families like the Busaidis or the Mandris, who are old Arab families who've been living for generations on the Swahili coast and of course have intermarried with locals for generations, get to start claiming being Arabs, right? And of course, claiming an Arab identity in the colonial racialized hierarchy of the British Empire gave some advantages. You were still a colonized subject, right? But you had some advantages. And these politics start playing out in these two mosques, right? So to give you sort of an anchor in the architectural history of those mosques, the Mandri Mosque has many histories. It has a firm foundation date in the 16th century, and it's connected to an old Arabian peninsula family, the Mandri, who came to the Swahili coast, according to oral histories, in the 16th century, or perhaps a little bit later. Of course, oral histories have different dates depending on who you ask. Then there is the Bashaikh Mosque, but it's important to point out that the Bashaikh Mosque has many names. The Bashaikh Mosque is also called the Tangana Mosque or the Minara Mosque. The Tangana Minara just means minaret or tower in Swahili. Tangana is the name of a lineage within the Tanashara Federation, within the Tanashara Taifa. And according to the interpretation of what happened to these mosques, according to members of the Taifas, right, these ancient indigenous lineages who have always claimed Mombasa as their rightful city, that is the Taifas built the mosques, both of them, right? According to their oral histories, right? Of course, oral histories, like all histories, say more about the present than the original moment that they describe. But nonetheless, they emphasize that both the Mandri and the Bashaikh Mosque were built by Taifa peoples originally, and that the Mandri Mosque was given to the Mandri in the distant past, sometime after the 16th century, and similarly that the Bashaikh Mosque, which is called the Bashaikh Mosque now, Bashaikh being an important learned family from originally the Arabian Peninsula, and was originally also a indigenous Taifa mosque connected to the Tangana lineage within the Talatha Taifa. But what happens during colonialism, that under the British administration, Arabs really became the state-sponsored stewards of Islam. So the ancient practices of Islam by quote-unquote Swahilis and Taifa members become Swahilis during the colonial administration. That is, natives, that is, they belong to the ethnic group Swahilis, and the making of Swahili as a distinct ethnicity can be traced back really to the colonial period, right? Their ways of practicing Islam, their textual interpretation of Islam, becomes more and more delegitimized in the context of colonialism, when the British more and more rely on really Middle Eastern Arabs and also Middle Eastern interpretations of sort of the key judicial texts of Islam. So they've become sort of, oftentimes their way of doing practicing Islam, cultural practices are always seen as not properly Islamic. And at the same time, they become poorer also in Old Town. That is, they also start being members of the Taifas, become less able to keep up the both mosques, that is the Sheikh Mosque and the Mandri Mosque, have caretakers and patrons that are no longer members of Swahili lineages or Taifa lineages. So now you have also Arab caretakers, that is people that are considered to be Arabs in the colonial regime of and colonial hierarchy. And so they start being seen, both the Mandri Mosque and the Bashaykh Mosque become really the story of ancient Arab architecture on the Swahili coast, right? Which, of course, the Talatha Taifa absolutely contest, right? And they also contest saying that these are Arab spaces, right? And this really comes to a very distinct head in a very specific moment in the 1920s, because all of a sudden there is really a drive by an elite member of the Arab community of Mombasa, that is Ali bin Salim, who was the Liwali or the Muslim governor of Mombasa, that is the Busaidi government of Mombasa in the 1920s. He excludes the Taifa members from participating in the first election of a quote-unquote Arab seat on Mombasa's legislative council. So he says Taifas, although they're his Muslim brothers and sisters, are not allowed to vote because they're natives and not Arabs. This caused a huge rift in Old Town Mombasa. And a protest movement was started by a leader of the Talatha Taifa, again being within the Tanashara. His name was Ahmed Motano, and he denounced Arabs during Friday prayers in the Bashaykh Mosque. Now, formally, or until that moment, the Mandri Mosque and the Bashaykh Mosque shared the responsibility of being the Friday mosques for being the place of communal prayers on Fridays, right? But he called out Serb Ali for this injustice, for trying to separate Muslims and the Arabs and quote unquote native Swahilis. And he called on a boycott of joining in prayer with other Arabs in the Bashaykh and Mandri Mosque, right? So that causes a huge rift of also no longer wanting this idea of being a shared Muslim community that has no ethnic boundaries becomes broken, quite frankly, from the 1920s until independence, right? And another story that Taifa members tell is that certain Arabs during the colonial period wanted a segregated space for themselves in the Mandri and Bashaykh Mosque. That is, that it should be segregated according to ethnicity, that Arabs should have actually a space in the front, and the Taifa, the Swahili, should be in the back, right? And of course, this was absolutely refused by members of the Taifa. And this contestation really caused this, and it's a contestation that people still remembered, certainly when I was doing field work, but it really was a memory really of older generations, right? So this is, of course, you can really see how stone architecture, two buildings, become contested spaces of who has the authority to be the stewards of Islam and the racialization of architecture, right? Interestingly, while some people, like Arabs of the of the Waqf Commission, that is the Endowment Commission, and the British colonialists always said the Mandri and Abu Sheikh Mosque are clearly Arab structures, but the Talatha Taifa, of course, talk about a fascinating example of the reinterpretation of architectural style, said no, both the Abu Sheikh and Mandri mosque are clear evidence of Shirazi or ancient Persian architectural styles being built on the Swahili coast. Now, of course, this is an interesting strategy among by members of the Taifas, because by claiming that this is an ancient Shirazi building tradition, or at least connects to an ancient Shirazi or Persian building connection, you still claim being part of the global urban ummah of Oceanic Islam, but you disengage it from an Arab narrative, right? Because at this point, of course, Arab was also racialized, right, in the colonial period. So here you see, right, this, the way that you then interpret even something as seemingly apolitical as architectural form becomes completely political, right? And again, here you see this obsession for political reasons and also for social reasons and for rights, for having rights as a citizen reasons, of something as seemingly ahistoric, as apolitical as style, how a building is built, right? How a building looks, right? But this obsession of being being able to find its true origin somewhere, right? This is a very, very Swahili coast phenomenon. And both of these mosques really sort of highlight the contested nature of that. And in some ways, when I was interviewing Mzee Montano, you know, it took him a long time to really tell me these stories, because today in post-colonial Mombasa, elders and old families of Mombasa, you know, are of course in some ways ashamed of this history of segregation between so-called Arabs and Swahilis. But of course, in reality, you know, quote unquote, Arabs and Swahilis have been intermarrying for generations, right? This racialization of their identity happened actually in some ways during the colonial period, although they in many ways participated in the racialization. But he, you know, he said that it's something that, you know, people, of course, now don't really want to admit. And certainly it is not there today. People pray together in the Friday mosques now.
Absolutely. And so I think you've drawn a really interesting picture of kind of the complex negotiations that are happening in the mid to late 19th century and even through the 20th century of kind of different ethnic labels that become highly politicized and mm-hmm. weirdly attached to objects, as though an object can ever be kind of rooted only specifically in one culture forever. Mm-hmm. And kind of points to broader questions in Indian Ocean history about how we begin to conceptualize space outside of standard area studies boundaries. And so I think coming on the tail end of this book, in which you are grappling with a lot of bigger issues about kind of the Swahili coast and East Africa's place in the world, you also had a really fantastic exhibition come out that you co-curated with Dr. Allison Purpura entitled World on the Horizon, Swahili Arts Across the Indian Ocean, which started at the Krannert Art Museum in 2017 and traveled to the Smithsonian National Museum of African Art and the Fowler Museum at UCLA in 2018. This exhibition was the recipient of two National Endowments of the Humanities grants brought together over 150 objects from public and private collections in Kenya, Oman, the Netherlands, Germany, and the United States, many of which have never been exhibited or written about before. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about this exhibition and the accompanying edited volume that you worked on with Alison Purpura, and kind of the interconnections that you see there and kind of this progressing narrative that you're telling of different histories and economies of the Swahili coast.
Oh, yes, I'd love to tell you a little bit more about that, because in some ways, World on the Horizon, I mean, was an incredibly satisfying project, coming especially after the book, because of course writing a book in some ways is a very lonely endeavor, but an exhibition is truly collaborative, and not only was I working closely in some ways, Alison Purpura was the sort of the founder of that exhibition, because it was her idea that we could pull something like that off at the small museum known as the Kainan Art Museum. But of course, we worked with so many important people and scholars in Kenya, in Tanzania, also especially in Zanzibar, and also gave us an opportunity to travel to Oman, which has, of course, you know, one of the great things is that, you know, Swahili heritage connects to Oman as well. And some of the greatest art, sort of like ancient heritage objects of Swahili heritage are in Oman, but of course also in colonial collections in Europe and North America. So the exhibition allowed us to bring all some of those objects for the first time together. And, you know, in some ways, the exhibition to me, I mean, of course, Alison has her own interventions and her own sort of strategies of why she did the exhibition. For me, for World on the Horizon was an opportunity in some ways, of course, to make what I wrote, the issues I was interested in the book, Swahili Port Cities, sort of interesting and relevant to a larger public, but also it allowed me to grapple with on a more sort of really concrete basis with the issues that I ended the book with, the conclusion, which was called Trading Places, where I really call out Africanist art historians, or challenge Africanist art historians that we should move beyond sort of studying ethnic culture or categorizing the arts of Africa or any parts of the world according to ethnicity, right? Even if we say, which Africanists certainly do, that ethnicity is performative and invented and is a cultural symbol, nonetheless, for better or for worse, a lot of Africanist historians, you know, of course, even some of my greatest mentors who have also influenced me in many important ways, you know, oftentimes focus on sort of like the history and of the arts of the Swahili people, of the Yoruba people, of the, you know, Bamana people, right? So this ethnicization of African art history is really what has troubled me really since the beginning. And World on the Horizon let me sort of explore questioning that straitjacket really in a concrete way, but also in a way that would be relevant to a larger audience, not just scholars or students or university professors, right? And World on the Horizon really was about that, you know. I mean, really, what is it? You know, of course, we still had the tie, we still had to have the marker Swahili arts across the Indian Ocean, right? But we had this, you know, we had this this call or the statement right in the beginning of the introduction of the accompanying volume, the edited volume that accompanied the book. We right away said that this project is about undisciplining art history, specifically undisciplining Africanist art history. What does it mean to not think of the arts of Africa or other parts of the world that are usually studied in the area studies paradigm? What if we what if we got rid of those boundaries, right? What does it mean to study objects and artworks and histories from an oceanic perspective, or not from the perspective of the paradigm of Africa, the paradigm of South Asia, the paradigm of the Middle East, right? And of course, then you become aware that, you know, this obsession with belonging and origins doesn't make sense at all with when you look at how Swahili arts are made, the histories that they embody, that an individual object holds, right? And of course, that these objects were conceptually always on the move, but also physically on the move. But the individual components, its visual style, is of course almost like an imbrication, an entanglement of multiple worlds on the surface of individual objects, right? The funny thing is that even though we said it over and over in the introduction, and all of the contributors who wrote incredible chapters in the accompanying volume, it was interesting to see even when the book was reviewed and the exhibition was reviewed for wider audiences. For example, the New York Times did a review of World on the Horizon. In general, the reviewer was incredibly positive and praised the exhibition exactly for what we said, you know, that it was moving beyond an ethnic studies paradigm. But in the end, he says, which I thought was so telling, that we're in some ways, you know, we're still trained to see the world this way. He was like, I'm still troubled though, because, you know, what is it about a carved Swahili door, right, which has sort of like stylistic features that look similar to to carving traditions in the Middle East and Asia or mainland Africa. Like, what makes it then original? How can you say it's, what makes it Swahili, right? That was at the end his question. He was troubled by what could be seen as an unoriginality, right? And of course, for me, this was like, wow, this is exactly, of course, the unspoken narratives that we have still naturalized, right? And it's still very much the bedrock of art history as a discipline, let alone Africanist art history, right? There's still this unspoken narrative that we hold on to, that somehow originality, true culture, somehow has to be anchored in place permanently. That there has to be something that allows me to say, this is anchored in the earth of Kenya, right? Of course, this is the narration of autochthony, right? Nativism, right? But this idea that originality can only be proven if it is anchored in this particular place is alive and with us today. And certainly in the field of art history, the larger field of art history, not just Africanist art history, you know, I know that sometimes my work gets looked at as a little bit suspiciously, you know, this like in between border space, like what is really African about this? Is she really an Africanist, right? Certainly, I know for sure that this still troubles the, you know, sort of these very entrenched truisms that are really foundational to art history. I mean, they're not just foundational to art history, they're foundational to many disciplines in the humanities. So it's interesting, even when we stated overtly World on the Horizon is about moving beyond obsessions with origins, in the end, people are still troubled what makes this really local, quite frankly.
Thank you for problematizing these facile and simplistic notions of indigeneity that are problematic in many contexts and politicized to different ends. And this is really useful, not just for people who are interested in the Indian Ocean world, but also in the Atlantic and elsewhere as well, where you have different worlds coming yes. together and forging new connections. Well, Preeta, we've taken a lot of your time, and I'm sure the listeners would like to know more about what you're working on next. And What do you hope to work on after these projects?
I've been working for a very long time already on completing a manuscript, actually on Swahili coast photography, which has been one of my long abiding obsessions, actually since writing the dissertation. The title, the provisional title of the book is Sea of Things, A History of Photography from the Swahili Coast. And in there, in some ways, you both will see continuities with my previous book on architecture, because in that book, I frame photography not so much like a static image or something, you know, or I don't only look into the photograph, but really I'm interested how photographs are material artifacts that are constituted by mobility, right? So in some ways, it's very similar to my interests on East African architecture, right? And it's really, the book really explores, similarly to my previous book, the everyday uses of photography. And in that book, I'm particularly interested in histories of enslavement and subjugation, and who is actually shown in these photographs, which are often people who experience subjugation and slavery, especially some of the women in the photographs. That's the project I'm working on right now. Yeah.
That sounds amazing. I remember looking at some of those during your presentation at NYU conference.
Now I see. I get it all. Yeah.
Yeah. Now it feels like ages ago. Well, I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for listening.
Thank you so much for giving me an opportunity to revisit my work with you.
Thank you. And thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored Swahili Port Cities, The Architecture of Elsewhere, published by Indiana University Press. This is your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi.
And I'm Jenny Peruski.
Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.